Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books and Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton of Deerfield Academy, and it's a total delight to be joined today by Rachel Gross. She is Assistant Professor of History and Co-Director of the Public History Program at University of Colorado, Denver. She's here to talk about her debut book. It's called Shopping All the Way to the Woods: How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. It comes out today from Yale University Press. Dr. Gross, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What a fantastic book. Oh my gosh. It is in turn delightful. It is sometimes kind of disquieting and disturbing. But most of all, it's just very clarifying. You make all these things that American consumers do and have done that we think of as normal, you make them all seem quite strange. And then you help us understand kind of how it came to be that way. And that's just what better work could a history book do? I love it so much. And I expect lots of readers are going to have quite personal reactions to the book. For me, I kept thinking about a t-shirt. This was a shirt my brother owned in the 90s, in the early 90s. It's a shirt I loved. It's a shirt I coveted. And I think it was from EMS. And it was sea green. I still remember the shade. And I know it had this letterboxed photograph image of the Tetons. And then in script above it, it said, there are places that stir men's souls. And then below the image, it said, find them. And I just loved it so much. And again, in your book, you helped me make sense of the forces, the economic and the technological, and especially the cultural forces that both created that shirt, led to the creation of the shirt, and also that led to 12-year-old Brian just lusting after it so much. In other words, you historicized it, right? And it was just so exciting for me personally to kind of be like, oh, I get it now. I get it all. And I wonder, when did you start to see gear and outdoor apparel as historical documents?
So I had long kind of had the same interest as getting the cool stuff that would represent like I'm a real outdoorsy person and I'm going to wear it in my everyday life. But I never thought of those items as historical or kind of telling any deeper stories than just about myself. Until I started a backpacking trip, going hut to hut hiking around the world in a year after college for a fellowship called the Watson. And when I was on that trip, I encountered kind of reactions all over the place that people had to what I was carrying with me. So I had a big backpack, I was wearing hiking clothes and boots, and people all over the world wanted to stop me to tell, my 22-year-old self, like, you're doing it wrong. Your backpack is too big. I can't believe you're carrying that stove. Like, everybody had all sorts of opinions and mostly very good natured ones, I should add. And what I realized is that so much of the kind of purchasing that I did in order to prepare for that trip were based on kind of my American assumptions of here's the right way to stay warm and dry on the trail. Like, here's the cool stuff and the effective stuff. And other countries, other cultures have different habits and expectations about what getting back to nature is all about and how to equip for it. And that was when I started to recognize, oh, there's a story here that's specific to the place that I'm from that it's possible to tell. And I didn't understand what it was, but I knew that there were some questions there I wanted to answer.
That's great. And you know, you begin this history of the outdoor industry before the industry really existed in any sort of recognizable way that we would think of today in chapter one here in the kind of the late 19th century, at a time when there were plenty of people going off to the woods and as many, if not more, writing about kind of what one should do there, why do that, what one should wear, what one should bring along. What were some of those do's and don'ts in the era before the industry?
I'm going to highlight the single most important rule, which was don't buy stuff. The recommendation in the woodcraft era of the outdoors in the late 19th century was don't acquire from a store, from a shopkeeper, what you could and should make yourself. Many of the guidebooks that you referenced suggested to aspiring outdoors people, you ought to be making your own buckskin suit after you kill a deer. You ought to be building your own campfire or camp bed. You shouldn't buy those things in a store because that would be evidence that you're a greenhorn, right? A newbie, a beginner, and you don't really know what you're doing. And so, yes, before there is a kind of developed outdoor industry, which happens around the turn of the 20th century, there are many kind of messages coming to aspiring outdoors people saying, if you want to do this the right way, don't shop, learn how to make yourself from nature's storehouse, right? That's the woodcraft ideal. And that's the way you're going to be equipped properly for the woods.
And it was so fascinating, and you call it, at times you call it kind of the ironic position of the industry, or you call it the enduring kind of inherited paradoxes of the industry, is that the industry really shouldn't exist by these terms, right? Because there's a lot of continuity in why we go out to nature, or why we talk about why we're going out to nature. And yet, at the origins here, there was no really opening for a Madison Avenue retailer or for really a market for mass-produced gadgets. These all seemed antithetical to that recreation. And so, how did it get going? You know, these soon appear around World War I era or so. How did the retailers confront these challenges of that seemed like a paradox at the heart of the enterprise?
Yeah, it does seem antithetical to what it means to get back to nature. And yet, part of the reason acquiring outdoor goods and clothing was so popular is because despite the best admonitions of the guidebooks, people didn't know how to make that stuff, right? And it's not very different from my lack of practical skill self in the 21st century, is that even folks like Theodore Roosevelt, right, mm-hmm. who we recognize sometimes now as kind of an icon of the rugged outdoors in the American West, he didn't know how to make a buckskin suit. He had to purchase it himself. And so many companies are responding to the fact that despite the ethos promulgated by the guidebooks, consumers don't know how to do these things. They live in cities, they're urban people, and they still want to get back to nature. And so buying the kind of the camp beds, the tents, or the jackets that they don't have time or inclination to make themselves is a shortcut, right? It's a way to make sure that they're going to survive their nights outside, still be comfortable. And outdoor companies are all too happy to kind of fill in that gap and make these goods available to them.
What are some of the ways they kind of hid that, or kind of like push that to the side, or kind of swallow the shame of that and kind of what they're doing?
One of the things I notice in the kind of marketing approaches of the early 20th century outdoor companies is suggesting that the shopkeeper, rather than being somebody to avoid, is an expert who you can trust just as you would a guidebook author, or even kind of you might have imagined that a Native American guide of the 19th century would have taken a similar role. That's the language of these catalogs. And so I see suggestions in the advertisements for a place like Abercrombie and Fitch in a magazine like Country Life in America saying, like, if you want to go on this canoe camping trip, yeah, stop by our store, you know, in New York City, in Manhattan, because our shopkeepers, they've just gone on their canoe camping trips. They know exactly what to buy. And so in some ways, having the people who work at the outdoor stores be a standard in terms of access to expertise and understanding about what it means to get back to nature is a way to soften the blow. If you're going to have to acquire these goods, which again, kind of inexpert consumers absolutely do need to if they want to participate in these activities and not build their own, then at least kind of talk to these new experts of the outdoors who are going to be the intermediaries to allow kind of the consumers to learn what they need to.
And this plays into the book's major theme on authenticity, right? This is if you can't make it yourself, at least you can get it firsthand from somebody that could conceivably make it themselves, right?
Yeah, I mean, get it firsthand, but also get the right stuff, right? Part of the notion of being authentic in the outdoors isn't just kind of get the right, you know, get a sleeping bag, period. But by the end of the 20th century, it needs to have the right brand. You know, it has to work in the right kind of way. It should be made of the correct materials. And I'm not saying this kind of from my contemporary perspective, suggesting there actually is a correct sleeping bag by any means. However, it's this notion of kind of if only we as consumers could learn rules, right, then we're going to be able to navigate these spaces better and more authentically. And that's part of what companies in the outdoor space have taught consumers since the early 20th century.
Understand how all this gets scaled up. We have to talk about World War II. It's one of the major turning points of the book. You narrate it very evocatively with the beginning with a phone call that Eddie Bauer and Leon Wood Bean, and these are Mr. Eddie Bauer and Mr. Bean, get from the U.S. Army. What is the Army calling about and what happens next?
Mm-hmm. The U.S. Army is calling Bauer and Bean because they have expertise in designing and manufacturing outdoor clothing and equipment for cold weather that the U.S. Army does not have. The military in the United States had not updated its uniforms, especially for cold weather fighting, since World War I. And so a lot of people from within the military were saying, like, oh, no, we're going to have a real problem should we enter the war. And so they called on civilian experts, among them many representatives from the outdoor industry, to be their guide as they started to produce new kinds of uniforms and pieces of equipment, not just for specialized soldiers like the ski troopers of the 10th Mountain Division, but for the many millions of American soldiers in kind of ordinary infantry divisions who also were affected by kind of the new designs that the industry professionals had to offer. So over the course of the war, it wasn't just that Bauer and Bean were producing respectively packboards and boots for the U.S. Army. It was also that civilian representatives were participating in the scientific testing in laboratories of new kinds of clothing, especially, but also equipment that was meant to figure out, like, what's the best new modern approach to clothing that we can take? How do we layer this clothes properly on people's bodies so they can survive in extreme kind of temperatures and other conditions? And so Bean, Bauer, and their contemporaries were involved in stateside in the design of new uniforms like the M1943 layering system. And then they brought those designs and those philosophies about uniforms and equipment back to their companies in the years that followed the war. That's how it scaled up and spread to civilians all around the country after reconversion.
Yeah, and they had their eyes on the peacetime market even in the middle of the war. We see that in some of the great images you include in the book, right? Like the Coleman stove, right? They're imagining that during the war, this is going to help him, the soldier, but soon it'll be for everyone to kind of do these
for
things.
For everyone, right. Exactly. Yeah. For American families who might like to camp. Certainly Bauer himself was not insensible to the kind of the potential that equipping U.S. Army men during the war would have when it came to the market afterwards, which is why he really pushed to have his Eddie Bauer tags included as a part of the packs and sleeping bags that he sold, which is very unusual for military grade equipment and clothing. But many soldiers came to learn of the quality of those down sleeping bags or those Bauer produced pack boards. And so they brought this brand affinity with them, much like they would for, say, Hershey's chocolate, back to their civilian lives in the years after the war.
And Lucky Strike cigarettes and all that. Yeah. No, and when I think about the technologies the military develops during the war, they get diffused out in the civilian sector after the war. I don't think about sleeping bags, but your book convinced me that I should. Could you say a bit about how, like materially, how these things went from Army property to civilian property?
Mm-hmm. So much of the testing laboratories that I referred to that created new kind of scientifically proven clothing and equipment during the war didn't actually reach many soldiers during the war because of how long it took to do that kind of work. That meant that by the time production really ramped up in these areas, especially integrating nylon, which the U.S. Army didn't have access to until very late in the war, into clothing and equipment.
Is they're using it for parachutes, or the Air Force did it all?
Yes, right? Exactly. The Air Force had commandeered all of the nylon that was available. And it had only been around, of course, for a few years. It was only invented in the 1930s.
Yeah.
So there was all this stuff. It was extra, you know, surplus goods. And the U.S. military sold it first to veterans and then to kind of anyone who could kind of get access to it and afford it. Huge lots of what some people called junk and other people called treasures. And these soldiers, these Army veterans, went on to start Army Navy stores, surplus stores, all over the country. What that meant was that whereas earlier in the 20th century, outdoor clothing and equipment stores were really highly specialized entities and only in a very select group of towns, cities around the country, after World War II, there were not outdoor clothing and equipment stores, but Army Navy stores with clothing and gear appropriate for those kinds of outdoor activities in every small town in America. The Army Navy stores, some of them are still around, but there were thousands and thousands of them after 1946, when the flood of surplus arrived on the civilian market. And so,
and the entrepreneurs would just essentially buy it and almost wholesale from the army and then be able to retail it that way themselves.
Yeah, often it was sight unseen. So they would bid on an entire lot and hope that there wasn't, you know, 100 sets of boots that were only the left foot. They wouldn't know necessarily if there were useful things to resell there. But at least in the very early years of surplus, the military goods had a very good reputation because in part they had been designed by experts like Bean and Bauer. They had been produced using high quality equipment or high quality materials such as down feathers in the sleeping bags that went into mountain sleeping bags for the ski troopers. And civilians knew to search out from the piles of goods those kinds of treasures. Those didn't stick around indefinitely, but for the years immediately after the war, stores such as Recreational Equipment Cooperative, what would become REI, were reselling surplus goods such as mountain tents and mountain sleeping bags to a very eager consumer base.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
And it became kind of a proof of concept for the market, right? That they're looking because the demand outstrips supply so much, right?
Right. People knew to search for these. And when materials once again became available, then it made sense for companies that couldn't have envisioned a vast market for specialized goods like down sleeping bags, suddenly saw the possibilities and went in earnest into the outdoor industry, whereas before it had been something only they had done kind of on the side of their regular jobs as teachers or bankers or things like that.
That's so fascinating. And so we get this boom in outdoor recreation in the 60s and certainly into the 70s. And at the same time, of course, that we have these roiling political movements in the country and you call out the New Left, you call out kind of the environmentalism that coalesces around the first Earth Day in 1970. And both of these, the kind of the major critiques of these movements would seem to cut right to the heart of the outdoor industry enterprise, right? I mean, certainly any sort of anti-capitalist attack on these corporations. And then also this idea of you mentioned a couple, right? You mentioned the fact, you know, there's Edward Abbey's, we're loving these places to death. And so we're just making, and you have people, old timers complaining, you're making camping too easy, too many people overtaking the landscape. But you also mentioned just the material production of all of this stuff, including synthetic goods, you know, synthetic products is also would seem to be ripe for attack by mainstream environmentalists. So how did the industry navigate such a tense period?
The overlap between environmentalists and the outdoor industry professionals is strong. In fact, nearly everyone whose sources I looked at kind of would have identified themselves as supporters of that kind of a new environmental movement, and they were quite concerned about the impact that their work was going to have on the broader environment. And so I see that a lot of the kind of hand-wringing about what's the impact of these new synthetic products going to be, what's the impact that our companies are going to have if we keep making the outdoors more accessible to more and more people, those voices are coming from within outdoor companies themselves, which is important because you can see a shift as both these kind of professionals, these entrepreneurs, and the people who buy from them, outdoor consumers, who are also kind of on board with these new politics, push for kind of new approaches from within the companies to address these concerns. Now, there are not holistic kind of shifts in how the businesses operate, right? There's still a bottom line that all of these companies have to adhere to. And yet, I see some interesting things show up for the first time. For instance, kind of outdoor companies organizing trash pickups in national parks, organizing letter writing campaigns to preserve wilderness area, rethinking how they take photographs for their catalog and sticking close to home rather than going far afield because that's going to have less of an impact on their environment. All of these things, which seem quite obvious to 21st century consumers, were actually pioneered by outdoor companies during the 1970s, in part because of the pushing that consumers did, you know, at these companies that they identified so personally with, and in part because the people who worked for them were very much on board with all of these shifts and wanted to think through carefully the ways that they could lessen their impact on the environment while still selling outdoor goods.
Mm-hmm. And next in the book, you track this explosive growth in the industry in the 1970s in a really engaging and innovative way by looking at two products side by side. One is Gore-Tex, the most modern of materials, and the other are these DIY kits that would seem to maybe be harkening back to an anti-modern, to a late 19th century idea at first blush. What do we get by juxtapositioning these stories side by side?
Mm-hmm. I used to think when I first started this project that the big story of the 70s was going to be the revolution in synthetic fabrics, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many of the catalogs, the backpacker magazines and the like announce a revolution in materials. And Gore-Tex is not the only one, but it's one of the best examples of that because of the fame that it went on to develop. Gore-Tex was invented in 1976, but it was not a radical success that overturned the industry in that year. It was actually pretty much a failure, in part because the first generation of Gore-Tex leaked. It didn't do the waterproofing, keeping dry that it proposed to do, at least at the outset. And the reason that I pair that story, the kind of slow rise of synthetics, not the immediate overwhelming boom, with do-it-yourself kits, the DIY sewing kits of the 1970s, is because that actually was the much bigger trend. Millions of Americans knew how to sew back then. And again, I'm going to put myself in the camp of people who no longer have access to those kinds of practical skills. but they learned in home economics classes often, or from their parents, their mothers most often, how to sew. And then they were more easily able to kind of take a kit that had all of the requisite parts and then sew together a down vest or a down sleeping bag for their outdoor activities. It seemed like that was going to revolutionize, way more than synthetics themselves would, how outdoor consumers access goods. Because outdoor products throughout this period, from the origins of the industry, have been very expensive and therefore only accessible to kind of wealthy individuals or people who plan quite carefully for their leisure time purchases. DIY kits were a good 50 to 70% cheaper sometimes than the kind of ready-to-wear vests or sleeping bags that you might purchase off of the rack. And so they seem to kind of expand access to high-end goods, and certainly to kind of welcome in a wider range of people, especially because the vast majority of those sewing the kits were women, not men, who were seen as usually the targets of the outdoor industry more than women were. And yet, do-it-yourself kits, despite their immense promise in the 70s, eventually failed. All these companies went bankrupt, got bought out, and kind of disappeared by the early 1980s, whereas Gore-Tex and its synthetic cousins took off in the years that followed. And so I pair these two stories together because they show kind of the surprising turns that outdoor consumers probably in the 70s themselves would not have been able to predict.
Why, I wonder if you could say more about why the DIY failed. You mentioned offshoring in the book. I mean, the cost competition it was offering to the more expensive goods was a big part of the story, mm-hmm. maybe not the whole part.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of different reasons. One is kind of demographic shifts. The baby boomers who had the time compared with the kind of budgeting inclination to buy do-it-yourself kits in the 1970s often had more disposable income and could afford for not very much more to buy ready-made goods by the early 1980s. Mm-hmm. Also, I should mention the kind of gendered component of do-it-yourself kits, the fact that so many times it was men buying these, but then turning to their wives or mothers to actually do the work for them. A lot of women perhaps started to say no, right? Even if they didn't express any, deep resentment at the time, either that kind of asking no longer became acceptable, or women started to say no to the requests. And so it was partly, at least according to outdoor industry representatives, the women's movement, the feminist movement, that actually shifted people's purchasing habits as well.
Okay, then by the time we get to 1979, things start to get really nutty. And L.L. Bean's iconic duck boot appears in a Calvin Klein runway show, I believe. How did we get there?
There is nothing more abhorrent to Leon Gorman, L.L. Bean's grandson and the CEO of L.L. Bean, the outdoor company at the time. He really shunned the notion that L.L. Bean products would be seen as fashion, right? This was a problem, not a boon for him, because he saw the authentic reputation of this company as a purveyor of outdoor goods resting on the fact that it was about functionality, right? That it worked mm-hmm. well. Therefore kind of stepped aside with these issues of what's stylish in the moment, because it was kind of, it was classic and it was, going to last far beyond these trends. The reason that, L.L. Bean boots won, stomped down, runways and won fashion awards in the 70s and, early 80s was because of the, preppy trend. college students in the East Coast and also folks around the country embraced outdoor clothing as a part of popular style, starting in the 1970s, to the point where it became kind of a like an everyday outfit as opposed to specialized equipment for an outdoor activity itself. For some outdoor companies, this kind of brought them skyrocketing sales, but also kind of a sense of soul searching because they were trying to figure out, what do we do with this immense popularity? We didn't set out to be a fashion company. We set out to sell functional equipment, and they weren't necessarily sure that they wanted to embrace this new set of consumers.
And that leads to today where, you know, you and I have grown up in a country where we see that the ubiquity of outdoor apparel kind of far from the trail, as you say, right? And it's, and I'm, when I first heard of this book, I was like, well, I need someone to explain to me why people walk their dog in jackets that look like they could be, you know, reaching the South Pole and that sort of thing. And so, and certainly the price tag's part of that too. And what you helped me understand is that to some extent, this was the industry's intention. But to a striking extent, it wasn't. And you mentioned Gorman, you know, because some firms really even resisted very strongly marketing to certain types of customers. And can you help us understand this tension?
Yeah. So Gorman and L.L. Bean's response during the preppy boom was to kind of both sell to these suburban moms, but also to like think through how are we going to present ourselves as still a purveyor of equipment first, even though we're doing our biggest business in areas that are not actually about fishing equipment and much more about women's everyday work apparel. Other companies came to different kinds of balances when it came to kind of recognizing and embracing or not the new consumer bases. A really good example of that is the North Face, which saw kind of a boom in popularity in the early 1990s as hip hop style led by young Black and brown folks in mostly men in the East Coast of the United States started to embrace puffy down jackets in block colors, like beautiful pieces of equipment for use in cities, you know, kind of on the city sidewalk in urban environments. And for companies like the North Face, which had originally designed for mountaineers, right, to take equipment to the top of mountains, this was a real kind of surprise because it represented something so different from the original intention. Ultimately, the North Face and other companies did embrace this new market, and they started to kind of make more accessible in the right kinds of sizes, in the right kinds of colors to their new market. Other companies were resistant to that fact and decided not to sell purposefully or to advertise to the people of color who started to embrace those styles in the early 1990s.
Timberland was one of those?
Timberland, it's a tricky story. I don't know that we can say definitively that Timberland either embraced or shunned them because the press from the time is actually mixed. But because the CEO of Timberland was quoted in a prominent newspaper during that time saying, like, actually, you know, the people who we sell to are real workers and outdoors people. There was a suggestion that he was making a coded racist statement about the young urban consumers who were buying Timberlands because of kind of the hip hop music scene that had promoted them so strongly during that same time period. I don't know if that was the intention, but that certainly is how the story of that company got reflected in the news. Now, Timberland absolutely embraces its urban wear lines and the customers who come with it, but the kind of discussions and the press around like, oh, what does it mean for Timberland to like have these ideas about who a real consumer is versus somebody who's kind of an infiltrator who doesn't belong, kind of reflects the broader tensions in the industry going on during that time.
I was really struck by the persistent and longstanding resistance to sell to American women, just because of the size of the market, if nothing else, right? And then you'd see that, and then when Eddie Bauer first did it, right, then they really took off, and it's just striking. And we often think about, oh, capitalism, you know, these corporations, you know, because they're listening to the bottom line, they might somehow find themselves on the front of these kind of revolutions, social revolutions, right? And we see credit, you know, new South companies with, you know, kind of, you know, desegregating to the for the point of for market access. And yet here we are, where you have these people being, I don't know, because the stakes for them was that they worried about the authenticity and the brand and this, and you get this heritage branding that you talk about later in the book. What's heritage branding?
Yeah, heritage is distinct from the history of a company because heritage is kind of like the packaging of it and the narrowing of that history to tell a really kind of a specific kind of story. A lot of outdoor companies at the end of the century start to embrace kind of heritage style, which means it has some historic roots to it, but it's a narrow version of that. So a really good example of that is Eddie Bauer, which was founded, I should be clear, in the 20th century, but started to publish catalogs that embrace the old American West of the 1880s and 1890s. Mm-hmm. That's a really good example of heritage marketing, right? They're suggesting this old West, you know, the white cowboy era, which is a kind of really vastly imagined one, is one that they embrace as a part of their heritage and a way to sell down vests to people who lived in the suburbs and who shopped in malls in the 1980s and 1990s. That's not what the history of the company was, right? Which has its origins in kind of Seattle sporting goods companies from later on in the 20th century. But that kind of storytelling about outdoor companies' past reflect their ideas about who their consumers ought to be and what kinds of stories that they would attach to outdoor goods. And so when people question, like, oh, why do we as everyday consumers who aren't about to go climb mountains embrace some of these goods? It has to do with the stories that marketing tells us these goods are attached to. And, you know, if a shirt dress from Eddie Bauer or L.L. Bean is attached to a vision of the old American West, that's part of what consumers are embracing, even if they don't make that connection directly.
Where do you think that the industry and its consumers are today in relation to that inherent enduring paradox of a commercial endeavor to support a non-commercial kind of recreation pursuit? Mm-hmm. I think about Patagonia closing on Black Friday. I mean, things like that. Where do you see, are there still vocal critics of the industry out there from a DIY perspective, from an, I don't know, anti-modern perspective?
There are absolutely still kind of DIY voices, you know, coming from the consumer saying, like, we can make some of this stuff better, lighter, and more effectively than outdoor companies. But actually, the vast majority of the conversation when it comes to kind of weighing the environmental impacts of outdoor goods on the environment that we all love so much is coming from within the industry. So When I've been in attendance at kind of outdoor retailer, like industry trade shows, so many of the innovative products are innovative precisely because they're thinking through the production process, the impact on the environment in terms of usage of water or petrochemicals in the products, or they're thinking about then kind of the cycle of waste and how to stop people from throwing out, you know, the shoes that they wear after just one season. And so in that sense, just like in the 1970s, I see kind of a lot of the interesting ideas about new ways of thinking through design and production, and even kind of the end life of outdoor products is coming from within the industry because the people who work in it are often quite passionate about lessening their impact or improving kind of how they do business.
That's really striking. I just think about, you know, people talk a lot about capitalism's ability to, you know, kind of absorb its critics and things like that. And way back to the Volkswagen's Think Small campaign and things like that. But here's an industry that to some measure was kind of built by its critics in some ways, or at least by a major threat. And it's really fascinating to watch it evolve. Unbelievable as it is, you have another book coming out just weeks from now. And I wonder if we can give you a chance to tell us a bit about it. It's called Big Box USA, and you're a co-editor on it.
Yeah, I worked with two other environmental historians on this book on big box retail and its environmental impacts. So listeners won't be surprised to hear that kind of the way that American consumers have bought not just outdoor clothing, but all sorts of goods has radically transformed in the last 50 years. Whereas early in the 20th century, we often kind of went to smaller scale shops, not chain stores, you know, that stretched around the nation. By the 1970s, it was discount retailers that were starting to take over kind of that market. And so that by the 90s and certainly by the early 2000s, so much of the shopping that we do is shaped by the very biggest of companies. Walmart, you know, is at the top of that list, of course, but Target, Kmart, and outdoor stores, in the case of my small contribution to this volume, REI, Cabela's, are all, kind of all models of the same kind of approach to shopping. This new version of retail, we argue in the book together, has had an incredible impact, not just on kind of the physical environment, but on our conceptions of what kinds of impact shopping can have on the environment. And that's the story we seek to tell from the 1970s through the early 2000s.
So again, Big Box USA is out from University of Wyoming Press in April. Are there any other current projects you're willing to give listeners a preview of?
I've taken a big pivot in my focus on public history, and I'd love to talk about that. Currently, I'm working with two other folks on a National Endowment for the Humanities grant on the history of the CU Denver's campus. It's called Auraria, and it is a campus that was built just over 50 years ago after urban renewal helped to displace and then a Chicano neighborhood called the, you know, that was a part of the west side of Denver in order to create the campus that our university now occupies. For that project, I'm helping to build a digital walking tour of the old neighborhood that reflects on the community that existed there and on kind of the process of displacement and what impact that story has had 50 years on the students and on the displaced Aurarians and on their descendants who now attend universities like ours on the campus. So stay tuned for a walking tour that you can access online of this campus that tells a story of displacement and community resilience that is mirrored in kind of histories of campuses all over our country.
Cool, cool. Wow. So if you live in Denver or you're making plans to visit, make sure you keep an eye out for that. But for the time being, this book again is Shopping All the Way to the Woods, How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. It's out today from Yale University Press, and its author is, and my guest has been, Rachel Gross. Rachel, thank you so much for your time and for this book.
Thanks, Brian.